Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to a special episode of Waypoint Radio. We've been fortunate enough recently to be doing some of these kind of interview episodes where we've been talking to various folks, including the developer of Norco. I talked to the designer of Tunic, and today I am happy to welcome head of developer relations, Arissa. And I don't know what it came. What is your head of Panic? Man.
Co-founder. Yeah, sure.
One of my favorite things when I interviewed Andrew Scholdeis, who's the designer on Tunic, the little cute fox fez kind of game that came out recently. I asked him before I did this exact sort of setup and interview. Was like, well, what do you want me to call you as designer? Like, found like what? And he's like, I haven't really subtle. And I was like, well, what are you going to put in the game credits? He's like, I don't know. Like, I'll let you know in a couple of weeks. And then, so I did that about a month before the game came out. And then I played it. Tunic's wonderful. Beat the game. And then, other than being excited to see the ending of the game, I was like, well, what did he put for his title? Like, he had to make a choice. And his choice was to make no choice at all. The game just starts with, like, Tunic credits and then just says Andrew Scholdeis and just refuses to assign any sort of attribution. Incredible. A creative director, nothing. The true sign of a creative director is that you just don't assign yourself the creative director.
You know, working with House House was super interesting on Goose Game because they kind of work as a collective. All of them sort of are on the same level. They make all decisions as a group, which means that when we came time to make the website, we had to write a little code to randomize the order of their names so that every time you load it up, it's never. Yeah, it's and the game, I think, does the same thing. It's pretty cool.
That is delightful. So I have the two of you here because as we speak, like play dates are shipping out to people across the world. Yeah, I assume the two of you are boxing them up in your house.
Yes. I'm just taking a break.
I'll get back to that. That was kind of where I wanted to start was, you know, you decided to make a boutique handheld in... Not knowing that there would be a pandemic that created a global shipping shortages, shipping crises. I don't know. Like you made it to some part of the end of that, the beginning of a different journey. But I don't know. Like what has that part been like for the two of you when you realized, oh shit, this is going to be, it was already a complicated thing we were biting off. Now we're dealing with a pandemic that is introducing 1,000 more problems.
It's the worst. It's really, truly the worst. I can give my answer that I really can give from perspective. But like, one of the things about Playdate is that it was such a gradual project. Like, there was never a moment where we sat in a big conference room and laid out the whole vision for this thing down to the smallest detail. And I think part of that was mental. There's no way we would have done it had we sat in that conference room. Like, we had to just chip away at it one very small milestone at a time. It's like, oh, I guess we got the screen working now. And, oh, hey, cool. There's a, you know, we made a game or whatever. That I think that's the only way it would have happened. And so pandemic times come and it's kind of a little bit more the same. It was like, oh, huh, that chip's getting harder to find. We're going to have to figure that out. And oh, wow, like boats are stuck in the water or whatever. Like it was just another series of those things as far as my brain goes. And now that it's shipping is the weirdest experience of all because we keep talking, like I keep seeing people posting that they got theirs in the mail and my brain is like, how do they get that? They're not supposed to have that. Like what happened? Like shifting from it's our project. I think Nevin said this today. Shipping from it's a consumer product is almost impossible for me. I don't know how long that's going to take. Arissa, how has the pandemic times treated you? Other than I don't get to see you anymore.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, I started at Panic in January 2020. And so
most of my time at Panic
has been the pandemic.
Yes.
So this is just normal for you. It's like,
this is normal.
I don't know what it was like when boats just went forward.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, it's my first time doing remote work, but fair, I mean, yeah. it went by pretty smoothly. I felt like we transitioned pretty quickly. But
yeah, me too.
Yeah, the like shipping this week, I was like, is it really happening? Like, yeah. I just can't believe it. And even though I've only worked on it for, 2 years, it just felt the pandemic just really extends the life and time.
Yeah.
But yeah, like now I'm like, oh, I guess I should start thinking about the future. Like I've just been mostly thinking about like, okay, how do we like get this out, and
that's
how do
totally
we make sure
true.
All the games are ready now. Yeah. It's like, okay, like how do I start talking to people outside of Panic? Like,
yeah yeah. And I mean, it's funny, Patrick, because I think you kind of mentioned this in your write-up, like the is it a thing or is it a platform thing,
right?
And now our brains are kind of like at that exact same question where it's like, you know, we did it, we shipped the thing. It went, honestly, probably, I think, better than any of us could have expected. And it's time to line up the future. Yeah.
But for Arissa, I'm curious, I know a lot of these games that are, shipping in the first sort of like season of the play date have been in development or even finished for, a pretty lengthy period. But given that the play date is this device that makes the most sense when you've got it in front of you, it's physical, it's interactive, I imagine talking to developers, trying to explain it to them, like, is sort of, you want to be there and like show, oh, hey, here's how it works. I imagine from your perspective, that must have been a challenge to sort of like, all right, well, how do we do sort of like this presentation explanation part of the process, given that usually what you do is like go to a GDC and like,
yeah,
have, here's a play date, mess with it. Does this bring any ideas to the table?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't had to do that yet. I mean, we're about to do a session with Montreal Indies in a couple of weeks, but like just thinking about like how do I talk about this thing without physically being there to like explain it to them and also make it interesting. It's so like doing it through Zoom is just so can be so boring. I don't know. Yeah.
When I was like when we were talking about it on our podcast this week, they were constantly having to redirect me. I was like, well, it's the best if I just kind of show it to you through my webcam and like, all right, move 5 degrees to the right. No, wait, now you've taken it off the webcam as I'm like trying to turn myself around. And actually most illustrative of that was like, I knew the game had sort of like a lefty mode, but I didn't understand how it worked. And then one of my co-hosts like explained to me how that functions because they'd read about it. And then as I did that, I just went completely off the webcam as I was like, trying to wrap my brain around turning it over. And then flipping it and trying to talk into the microphone at the same time.
Yeah.
One of the things that when I was trying to sort of sketch out my review, I was trying to be overly clever and think, okay, I'm going to open a piece with like, what is my rich history with Cranks? Do I have like a story of like an emotional story of my experience with a Crank that I could like open with
this and beautiful like, black and white flashback.
Yeah. I was like, no, it was like one of like the rich friends of my parents like had a boat, and I remember one time
like
cranking.
Getting to do the thing? Yeah.
Getting to do the thing.
Maker?
To get the boat.
Do you have a pasta maker?
No.
Yeah,
no,
me neither.
I'm not making my pasta. That didn't change in COVID. That was not true when I was younger.
Yeah.
But
it turns out they sell them in a box, and then that's
just fine. It's easier for the kids too. But I did, like, I was curious, I know that, I saw the Polygon piece cable in which like the Crank sort of just like came back as an idea as part of this, like the development process. But like, I don't know, like the form factor of a Crank, like, does that jog any memories for either of you? Or was like your experience with the Crank, experiencing it in this device itself?
I mean, for me personally, yeah, I don't think I have a like formative Crank years, but I do know that with the the arrival of the iPhone, and I felt this with Jesper, who is the sort of lead designer at Teenage Engineering, with the arrival of the iPhone, I definitely started to get less and less interested in just tapping on pieces of glass all the time. And, yeah. and we still have game consoles, which is great. And of course, I still love them profoundly, but the device I interact with the most on any given day, for better or usually for worse, is my iPhone. So it was, it definitely was like, oh man, to like, that's an action that seems like it would be really cool. And like, I wish I could say that like, my pa and I went fishing every weekend or whatever. But that
I know.
I would be truly lying if I said that. I spent most of my time in my bedroom on my computer. So, but perhaps it is a fantasy of something that I didn't have, which was a more real world physical childhood. Yeah, I don't know. It just felt like it could be fun that you have infinite rotational ability. You can detect the precise degree. I don't know. Arisa, do you have any crank memories?
I mean, I'm just like thinking about it for the first time. I'm like,
I know, me too. That's a really good question.
Well, I do. What comes up in my head is like sharpening pencils in elementary school.
Legit.
Mm. Yeah.
That actually always feels really good because
because
then you hit the resistance when you start to get to the part that's unsharpened and then eventually it eases off. Okay.
Yeah.
That's my answer from now on, Arisa.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Because I've recently re-encountered that because I have a 5.5-year-old and a 2-year-old mm-hmm. and the oldest is really loves like drawing things. The youngest just likes breaking things. And maybe they'll meet in the middle.
That's a great combo.
Someday.
Yeah.
It's a great combo for the oldest who likes to make things and watch them get broken by
them. Be destroyed.
Yeah. It's like, whenever she's doing something delicate, it's like, just go somewhere else. Like lock yourself in a different room of the house.
Like a safe room. Like,
yeah. I was like, you understand how doors work now. You can actually lock it and I won't get mad at you because I understand that you won't get stuck in there, but I need your sister will otherwise come in and break your pencil.
Man.
So but she's like, we've been buying like nicer sort of drawing tools for her as she like has gotten more precise, and like one of those has been like colored pencils, which meant we got like a pencil sharpener, and it was the first time probably since grade school, like I'm not a creative person myself, that I touched one of those, and I was like, This is a very satisfying process to hear, like that wood being like kind of like ground away a little bit. So I ended up like messing up the first couple pencils because like I'm more interested in the process of this pencil being sharpened than I am in getting you the pencil for you to use for your drawing. But it's funny because the thing I actually landed on when I was like thinking about cranks was like two things. Was that like a deep love for like the Resident Evil series when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And so those games and games like that have like a long history of, if you find the 3 diamonds and you stick them into the tiger helmet, that will reveal a crank that you will turn.
Yes.
That will, and then open up a secret passageway that reveals the laboratory that's been underneath you all along. And so like when I really did think about like, what is my history like turning cranks? It's like, well, it's like interfacing with text that says like, do you want to turn the crank?
and slowly rotates on screen.
And then watching watching a 90s FMV play out. And then this that connected to that, which is maybe more relevant, is that I, since I was very young, not something I could articulate until I was older, always found like video game accessories that allowed me to interface with games slightly differently than the like traditional controller interface to be like really satisfying and interesting. Like it explains why I loved like music games. Mm-hmm. Like I was importing Guitar Freaks and Dance Dance Revolution before those were like available in the United States, because for some, even though like I'm not even a big music person, I can't dance. I found like the notion of like interacting with a game different than like hitting A and hitting B and hitting L1 and analog sticks to just be interesting. So my as a teenager, like when the Dreamcast came around, that was like the machine made for weird accessories. I had the fishing controller.
Good. I was just about to ask.
Yeah, yep. I had that, Samba de Amigo, which was a game where you had the maracas. And all sorts of other shit because, and this extended as I got older to like finding things like the Wii or virtual reality. Like I just find myself, maybe it's because I play games so much that I just desperately need to find a different, like maybe like the pessimistic view of this is that I play so much of these things that I need a different way to think about them. But the optimist view is that I think games have standardized their control interfaces, and that naturally constrains the possibilities of the design space. And so what I find interesting and novel is that, even if it comes across as a gimmick at first, I like the fact that things like the Playdate or like the Wii introduced designers, well, okay, but like, what if there was a different way mm-hmm. of doing this? Like, what would that end up in? And I have to imagine that's what was a lot of the early conversations, especially Cable, like early
yep.
on.
Yep.
Was like, all right, we have this device in theory. What the hell does this mean for like people doing something with it?
And that's interesting too, because I mean, okay, starting a platform, trying to find people to make things for your platform, right? That's difficult. Developers are busy. They have bigger fish to fry. They have bigger dreams. And so I think two things really did help us a lot. I mean, the Crank is an obvious one. When you go to a certain type of game developer and you say, here's this thing, and look, there's a Crank on the side, their brain will just immediately explode with ideas and they'll want to jump on immediately. And that's really fun to watch. And I think it ties back to exactly what you just said. You know, we are so familiar with these controls, but the second you show a developer or potentially also a gamer, look at this new thing, then you just can't help but start imagining ideas. And, you know, the screen also kind of worked oddly in a different way. Being one bit, I think, helped a lot. Where like, mm-hmm. it's just black and white. Like, you're not going to be, you know, anyone can make art for this thing. Like, truly, like it's. The bar is mellow and approachable. And so, I don't think you're alone. I think that it's just exciting to experience something new, both as a player and a developer. And it was interesting how some developers would make a great game with the Crank and others just pretended like it wasn't there at all. And, you know, we stood back and said, make the game you want to make. Like, that's not why we're here. But that was kind of fascinating. Like, obviously, Akita Takahashi, it'll be all about the Crank, guaranteed, right?
Right.
But maybe not for everybody. And some are a mix, you know, Zipper. Yeah, anyways. But yeah, I think you're not alone. And I think that is a compelling and interesting thing. Now, the thing we have to be careful about, right? Everybody seems to have this line in their mind, which I call the gimmick line, which is a classic internet thing. I can never quite tell where that line is. It seems to
is
be
it complimentary
subjective.
Or yeah, is it yeah, dismissive? Right. And I struggle with that myself because I think in some ways, like, It's a gimmick until it's proven that it isn't. And then analog sticks were a gimmick until, you know, Mario 64 made it to, oh, wow, actually, we've been doing games wrong all along in 3D spaces, right? And so it's almost like the, you know, the designers will prove out whether something, the Wii, motion controls aren't as popular as they were in the past, but it's a gimmick in the sense that I think we use gimmick because it's different from our, like, it's a,
correct.
Away from the, it's a standard deviation. Like, it goes away from our, the norms, and then it's like, but the norms were good. I like pressing the A button and the point thing junks. And it's like when you introduce the notion of, yeah, but what if you like flipped the device and it detected that you moved it and then you jumped? And it's like, all right.
Right.
You know,
right.
And then I think it just kind of depends on, you know, it's sort of at that point up to the device and the games that surround it to sort of justify, is this something that is a curiosity of like, oh, this is an interesting experiment. Or does this introduce the notion that like, This could have like long-standing implications for how we think about interfacing with games.
Now I kind of want like a Wikipedia gimmick index that's like, was it called a gimmick, and then did it ultimately be a gimmick? Do you agree, Arisa? Like, with do you think that what is the line between gimmick and not gimmick?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I agree. It's like being proven otherwise afterwards. I guess time.
Time is
it
the
takes
key
time.
Element. Right. Yeah. Okay, we got to hang in there. as long as we can. We got to get the green row on the spreadsheet of gimmicks. Yeah.
Well, you know, because if you think about like something like music games, right? Like Dance Dance Revolution, like you know, it was a gimmick, but also games like that, Beatmania, essentially, you know, birthed a genre, which is like, oh, actually, you know, we don't get Rock Band and, you know, Guitar Hero and other ways of sort of like turning, simplifying the interface for like simulating a, like a music instrument without something that's like, I don't know, what if you hit big arrows that sort of went to the beat, which like it is a gimmick, but I think the gimmick can then gesture at like a deeper idea that the gimmick is like articulating, right? Like, and I think you can draw a direct line from like motion controls to VR, which is like, oh, but like, what if your body was more involved in the process of interacting, and it wasn't just the controls are, you know, manipulating a thing on screen. It's like you're in VR, like your head's involved, or increasingly mm-hmm. the controllers can detect your fingers, and you can, you know, like the Quest and like the Index can tell that your individual fingers are moving, like, you know, relative, as opposed to, you know, it just being like a big button that you're holding. And so I think all that stuff, like, it's almost like you're like kind of scratching at the surface mm-hmm. of a thing, and you're like not sure how deep that hole goes. And it can be the case that maybe, you know, I guess I hope Cable and Arista, for your sake, the play date like is the thing, but it's also that like maybe it's a stop on the road to like a broader understanding of like, oh, we look back in 10 years and like these are like kind of steps on the road to, oh, we arrive here because people were trying this.
Well, you know, it was interesting because when Jesper first showed us his dream design for Playdate, and it had the crank.
I wonder if he has a black and white, and where did like that studio has black and white memories of cranks. And
that's actually a really good question. I wish I could talk to Jesper. I feel like it would be totally in the Ratatouille moment.
Do you have a sad crank memory about a family member that tragically passed, but the crank is what you think about? Like that's what I'm looking for.
Well,
it did. I know.
Tried
to get the crank, the and it, no, it broke.
The rope broke. Yeah. Oh, great. Now my video looks frozen. Why?
You're okay. You look okay on my end.
Yeah.
I don't know why my computer is garbage today, but in this pose that I'm frozen in, I don't know if you get the same one.
You're
moving.
Your wonderful face is still moving.
Incredible computer. He had many ideas, and it was not just the crank. And there was like a touch sensitive slider he wanted to put on there. Hmm. And there were like some other, he really wanted to do like a spring loaded thing on the side, almost like a pinball plunger.
Oh, wow.
And that to me was, I somehow personally managed to hit the gimmick line. I was like, I think if we load this up with like 3 to 9 different physical controls, people are done. Like, it's hard enough explaining Playdate as it is and then having to explain the season of games and stuff. Let's just stick with, and there's also a crank.
You would turn it into, did you ever play the game Bop It? Do you remember that?
Oh, I love a Bop It.
Essentially, what you're describing is like a Bop It. It's like
twist
like,
it.
Yeah, punch turn it. Yeah, and you would just do crank it. All right, now I got to pull the thing.
Drop it. Yeah. No, actually, don't drop it. Yeah. Yeah, Bop It. Man, that was a good piece of electronics. Hey, Patrick, speaking of plastic guitars, which I also loved, this really isn't important to this interview, but I am curious, what do you think happened with that industry? Did it blow up too big? Did it get too large? Did it crescendo with Beatles Rock Band, which they maybe overshot? Because I want those still, but they're gone. I can't buy them PS5 or my... Yeah.
Yeah. No, it super bums me out. Those games, I feel like... Well, the expensive peripheral like had its like day in the sun in the Dreamcast and then the Wii era.
Yeah.
And it's like, it seems like at some point, I really wish those things had a subscription service. That's the thing that killed it for me, right? It was like,
I
loved Rock Band and then got really tired of paying $12.99, you know, every week to get the songs that I wanted. I would much rather have said, look, can I just pay $20 a month, download whatever I want, and then lose access to it so that like, say, hey, when I have a party, I'll just sign up. And it just seems like that would have been maybe a more sustainable way of...
Yeah.
They kept putting out these new additions, like a Beatles Rock Band. And they were like big boxed things. And like that was their revenue stream, was like having to put out like essentially like a new Madden. It's like, here's the new Rock Band. And I can't help but wonder, would it have been more profitable or at least more sustainable to just give people like sustained access to the music over time in the way that we have, you know, we have so many other subscription services.
Well, at the time, there probably weren't that many subscription services, right? That was like right before Spotify, definitely right before Apple Music. The music industry maybe wasn't ready. Oh man, I think you're right. I think that would have been a
dramatic
difference.
And they would have to renegotate all the rights to like music they already owned. So like you just couldn't do it. And they're still putting out tracks for Rock Band. Like it is not a dead project, but it is not alive in the way that you know, like you're speaking to it, which is like I would like brand new, like high-end peripherals that I'd be happy to pay hundreds of dollars. Like it is one of those things that I kind of wish if they did some sort of Kickstarter for, or like they're owned by Epic now. Come on, use a little bit of fucking Fortnite money.
Come on, right? Just like lift up the couch cushion.
Yeah, give me a taste of like you can take the brunt of the expensive peripherals, like Tim Sweeney.
For
like
sure.
you can do this for me. And so I don't know, like I desperately loved that era, and I at least got it far enough that, never dreamed of being a musician, but the thing that I always, some people do air guitar and air drums. Mine was always the keyboard. And so when they finally in Rock Band 4 got around to doing keyboards, and I was able to like actually simulate kind of playing a synthesizer, which I cannot and have no interest in doing in real life. I just want to jump I want to be like in the Matrix. Which
you don't
is like,
want to learn.
Just, no, I don't want to learn. I just want to noodle with it and like feel like, and like it legitimately fulfilled a dream. Like to be
able
to do that.
That's the best case scenario.
And it was super cool. And then they just immediately dropped support for the keyboard because nobody else wanted to do the keyboard. And
Damn it.
That part sucked for me personally, but I at least got like a brief window in which I got to kind of experience it. And that moments like that were an articulation of the gimmick line that we're talking about, which is, is like, again, even Rock Band itself is a collection of gimmicks put together, but it also simulates like a fantasy and allows people who have no musical ability whatsoever, may not even be an ambition thing. It's just like, my fingers don't work that way. My brain doesn't work that way. I'm never going to be able to even get amateur status. And something like Rock Band allows me to like just like gesture at that and like get a sense of it. And it was really fucking cool. Like it really,
that's incredible.
It meant a lot to me. And now it's all gone and you can't connect it to your
monitor.
I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to bring up the sadness.
Sad crank story is that I can't play the Halloween soundtrack on my, they never did that. That would have been what I would have paid for.
They should have done that. That's a really good one. Yeah.
Well, the new Halloween soundtrack that John Carpenter did with his son is extremely good. It's got a guitar in it.
Man,
anyway.
Can we talk about John Carpenter being the best? Okay, anyway, that's another podcast for another time.
But, you know, Arissa, I'm curious, you know, what were, I think the first, you know, as Cable said, as anyone that's seen the playdate, you know, the first question is about the crank. I'm curious, as you talk to developers, like, I don't know, like, what questions were they asking you about the device that, that maybe you noticed over time were like the kinds of things that people like immediately started buzzing about?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the people we've talked to, they were already very excited about Playdate. Mm-hmm. And so what we did was we sent them a Playdate to kind of play around with it. So I don't know, they didn't really have any questions about, or like, I mean, they're excited about the crank and like how they can like implement that into their like gameplay. Yeah, I don't know, Cable. Can you remember anything? Like, it's
no. weirdly, there was not. Again, it depends on the developer. I feel like the reaction, and I know, Arissa, you kind of arrived after we had signed a lot of those developers, but you did help us sign a lot more. But I feel like it was just a switch. It was either, hey, that looks pretty cute, like good luck with that, or it was like, give me that right now. Immediately, because I need to do something for that immediately. And so I don't know if that's like an interesting personality test. I mean, honestly, we're probably seeing, you know, there's the same thing happening with customers. I doubt there's any line in between. Yes, I resonate with that. I want that right now. There's probably not a lot of people that were on the fence. I mean, maybe this week, maybe we proved ourselves slightly. We always have more to do. But it's just an interesting binary, I think.
Yeah, I know. I think you, that definitely speaks to something. Like when I remember when I saw it, I was like, oh, this speaks to me, and I don't know why, but I need to turn this thing and see what people do with it. And I think that kind of like polarizing reaction, which is good, right? Like I wrote in my piece that, you know, I love the Steam Deck. It's a great machine. It's like the thing I've used the most in the last
really
couple
incredible.
Of months. Very excited to see what they do with it. But like as I put in my review, it was like, well, the Steam Deck you look at and Valve said, yes, and what else? Whereas I looked at the Playdate, and it seemed like a device in a very sort of Apple-like fashion in which there were a lot of no's involved, right? You know, it was like, well, we could do this, but we're not going to do this. Yeah. Or we tried this, and we're not going to do this. And it's more, whereas, like, I see all those compromises and decisions and choices in the Playdate, whereas, like, a Steam Deck I look at, and they're just like, no, we can do it. Like, we got it.
I like the voice.
For yeah, it's like, so I put a gyroscope in that thing. Like, why? It's like, for aiming. All right.
Yeah.
They're, like, yelling into a basement, and there's just a guy jamming a gyroscope into the
Steam Deck. Now, Arissa, you worked at Valve. Are we describing Valve accurately? Is this exactly
totally.
What?
Totally.
Yeah, okay.
This is so
that's
accurate.
What I thought. That's
yeah, Gabe's
exactly
just in
I
the
thought.
Basement, like, jamming gyroscopes into the devices.
Yep.
Somebody had a gyroscope.
That's exactly.
Two track beds.
yeah, Yes, like I'm trying to rein myself in. The you're correct. And you know, we explored some wild ideas.
Right.
And so people at Panic are very kind and very good and very smart and won't be like super rude or abrasive if I'm like, hey, what if the back, maybe what if like you take off 4 screws at the end of the season and you remove a backplate and there's a secret little color screen that's been there the whole time, which is actually one of my real ideas. And we like explored it, and Dave like kind of very politely hinted at maybe that's a little too much. It might be a little bit too complicated and expensive. And
maybe we don't
else.
Want everyone breaking their devices, yeah, and exactly. then having to ship them back.
Also, to me, it seemed very funny that like you've been playing on a black and white screen this whole time, but there was actually a tiny backlit color screen that you didn't know about. And I'm like, that will be hilarious. And then I started to think about it more. I'm like, oh, actually, no, I think that would actually make a lot of people quite angry. So, yeah. Anyways,
it'd be better if it was in one in every like 5,000. I was like, look,
see if you got the
you might
screen.
Have the gold. Would you like to open up your boutique handheld?
Good luck. It will void your warranty, but you might have a color screen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Disclaimer, please don't open the back of the plate. Please. It's not
true. There's nothing in there.
I appreciate you being responsible, Arissa.
Arissa, what did you do at Valve before you came to Panic?
I was in the business team, so I worked with the publishers, developers, helped release their game, market their game. So, yeah.
I don't want you to get in trouble for saying anything secret. Were they working at the Steam Deck when you were at Valve?
Yeah, they were. It was very, very bulky when I saw it.
So sometimes I get really self-conscious about the fact that it took us a very long time to make Playdate. Like, I mean, 5+ to 8, depending on how you're counting years. And so, but like, I was thinking about it this morning, and I realized, I like that I'm interviewing myself now, Patrick.
No,
I'm
please. Really, it could be a little self-analysis session.
I was thinking...
I'm going to cry about some cranks, talk about working on a thing for a decade.
Maybe that's how long it takes to make a hardware project when you're, what, 9 people, like 8 right. to 9 people maybe were the core of the team. Plus, we don't crunch. Like, nobody's in the office on the weekend and nobody's in the office
you're
after 6.
You're not cranking
6.
Out.
It can't be helped to do that, Patrick. It cannot be helped. But I think I feel good about that. So if you could just lie and tell me that the Steam Deck also took 8 years,
I don't even know what year it is right now, but I mean, maybe.
Okay, good. I mean, maybe is all I need.
I interviewed some of the folks over there in advance of that coming out. And in some ways, yes, like it has been almost a decade. If you talk about like the Steam Deck doesn't work without Proton, like the Linux layer
that was
essentially translate the code. And so like their interest in Linux and like building a way that like, how do we ask people, no one's going to port their games. How do we like just figure that out and
right.
essentially do that in real time? Like this, like that work in which like one of the primary engineers, Pierre, like on the Steam Deck was like, pioneered that work at Valve, like, you know,
amazing.
Going on a decade ago. And so there is a world where Cable, you can tell yourself,
I feel good now.
You work just as fast as Valve to get out the Steam Deck.
Yeah. I mean, Valve has Valve time. We have Panic time.
Oh, yeah.
It might be the same.
Be the same time. Oh, no.
Oh, see, I feel like Panic time was when I read the blog about the battery or the CPU.
Oh, tell me about it.
I felt reading that, I was like, I just feel like I can feel the sweat coming through this blog post. For people who don't, you were listening, there was a moment where, well, I guess maybe it's easier for you to explain, Cable, but basically you had to like change a CPU and like, because the global pandemic said, what if you don't want to ship this for 3 more years?
Yeah, there's been multiple of those, but the biggest one for sure was right when we were on the brink of shipping, when we said we would ship late last year. We are sending out new units. Arissa, you almost know more about this than I do, but we were sending out new units to developers and they would be like, hey, it's kind of behaving weird or it won't turn on. And we're like, what do you mean it won't turn on? Which is definitely not what you want to hear. And what happened, Arissa? I mean, they were just bad batteries, right? We were just getting bad batteries.
Yeah.
Man. And so we switched, fully switched battery suppliers at pretty much the 11th possible hour. I mean, like a genuine
I'm sure that's fine,
nightmare.
Right? It's just a couple of emails, a phone call.
I actually have a note somewhere in my phone when I was at the darkest place sometime before Christmas. And I found it. I was I was honestly, my first reaction to this, and I don't know what this says about me, was like, I think we're done. Like, maybe we need to cancel Playdate.
This was a good
like,
run, you know?
We got really far. We're going to disappoint some people, but that's okay. We can refund everybody or whatever. Like, I mean, I really hit that point, which actually kind of surprised me because I kind of kept it together this whole time. But my son, who is now 12, obviously could sense in the household that I was not in a great place. And he like came into my office out of the blue. I'm going to read you verbatim what he said to me. And he said, you're going to find a way to fix this. You've been working on this thing for almost 10 years. He was a couple years off, but that's okay. And you fixed so many problems. The world won't let you stop here. And I was like, Joey, I just burst into tears.
That's your Craig story. That's your Craig story.
There it is. So, I mean, honestly, it really did help to hear him say that. I mean, it was really did kind of make me realize we have overcome so much. This is just another one of those little anecdotes for a podcast someday. We'll get through it. So anyways, it totally sucked. And I'm sure there will be another one at some point in the future. But we're here today and we managed to ship at least some units this week. So
and mine turns on. It's still on. So
yeah, it's all that. Thank God. it sucked.
I guess the last question I leave on, because I know, Kibble, you have a heart out in a minute here, is...
Yeah, I wish I could say.
Well, we could always next time. Okay. Is the thing that probably delighted me the most was, so I think my favorite games like balance between Cranking and Omaze, right? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
That game just really broke my brain and just delighted in like having to figure out, okay, I would like tell myself in advance, like, all right, so I'm going to go clockwise 30 degrees and then switch and then I'm gonna go counterclockwise because there's that object that switches the direction, so I'm not going clockwise, and like, and I'm like having to sound it out like I'm doing a strategic move on a board game before like I do these actions. And in some of the later levels, the thing that really got me was discovering that the device can detect if the crank is put away or not. And there's a mechanic, I don't want to spoil it for people who eventually get into playing this, but like there's a mechanic that involves like putting the crank in and taking it out. And that just, I then had wanted to just ask, like, at what point did you decide, like, you were saying, there's a lot of things you said no to, but at some point someone said yes to, like, we also need some sort of way to detect that the crank is put away so that the software can tap into that. And I'm just curious, like, what the story is on that.
I think that was a Dave. And I think the part needed to do that was really cheap. And he realized that if you just tuck a little magnet sensor into the cavity, I think that really just came from him. And it was one of those things where like, yeah, of course, sure, why not? It might be helpful to know whether it's docked or not. Of course, we were thinking more on a practical basis. Like, it would be great if we could sense that or whatever. And I feel like the satisfaction for me of this whole project, beyond anything that I could have imagined, was people taking the thing that you built and had an idea of and making it do things that you never even could have imagined. And I think that's one of the reasons why we made Pulp too, was I want to extend that to everybody. I want to see everybody make something that I couldn't have imagined, because it is just so incredible and energizing that Cable's going off the rails again. As human beings,
you're hitting your heart out, Cable. Don't rant too far as you try and
blasting through that heart out, Patrick. there are so often overwhelmed, especially like even on Twitter when there's like a hashtag for like, you know, portfolio day or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, I want to see this. There are so many talented people on this planet. It is like overwhelming. There are like, I feel like, nearly infinite untapped and often tapped creativity. And some people have that outlet and some people don't. And the fact that we can make a little box and set some parameters and give out an SDK for free and make a little Pulp thing. And now we kind of just, we don't get to sit back and relax. It will never be relaxing, but now we get to kind of just look at this and see what people do with it. Anyways, that I think that's a good example. All we had to do was put a little magnet sensor on the PCB next to where the crank goes, and let's see what happens from that. And to me, that is the part of this whole project that has definitely made the last 5 to 98 years fully worth it. I don't know. Yeah. I think that's my answer.
All right. Well, you know, just for the record, PR, I got him as close as I could. He knew. He knew what he was doing.
Nick is like, no, you did great, Patrick. I'm so sorry.
I did 46. Pretty good.
I'm actually headed to, of all things, a workout, which is it's slightly embarrassing to mention. I'm trying to get exercise.
Well, good for you. Hey,
Emma gets very grumpy if I'm late. I have to not make Emma mad. So anyway.
No, you're good. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you to Arisa and Cable for hanging out and chatting to the Playdate. Congrats on getting it out. And
thank you.
Looking forward to seeing more.
Yeah, and I hope we can talk again sometime. It's really nice to see you again, and I hope you're doing well, and someday we can hopefully say hello in person. We'll see.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Cool. All right. Take care. Thanks for the time, everyone.
Bye. See you.
Yeah, enjoy your weekend. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time.
Bye.
You can find more information about the Playdate at play.date. I've got my review up on the website where you can read all about my impressions. I talked about it on the podcast fairly recently as well. Unfortunately, due to production delays, if you go and pre-order one now at play.date, can't get one until 2023, although I'm sure someone willing to part with it for a lot of money on eBay. But my thanks to Cable and Arisa for joining me. We're going to take a quick break and then come back with a out of left field interview with filmmaker Neil Blomkamp, who is involved in an upcoming Battle Royale game. Rob and I had a chance to speak with Neil. See you after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back. A couple weeks back, Rob got an email that was like, hey, do you want to talk to filmmaker Neil Blomkamp? He's involved in a new video game. And obviously, like, Blomkamp has had, you know, for years was trying to adapt Halo into a movie, as talking about how things like Half-Life and the aesthetic bled into films like District 9. I was like, Rob, let's just say yes. Just say yes. We need to say yes. Just say yes. Why not talk to Neil Blomkamp? What's the worst that can happen? And the best that can happen is that you talk to Neil Blomkamp and he compliments you on your Children of the Corn t-shirt, which I don't even know if that made it in to this edit, but just know that he did like my stylized Children of the Corn t-shirt, to which I then pitched him on watching Children of the Corn 2 and 3. Your mileage may vary on that. Anyway, he is involved as a chief visionary officer at Gunzilla Games. We're working on an upcoming Battle Royale. They're calling it Battle Royale 2.0. Yeah, a game called Off the Grid that's coming out in 2023. We talk about, like, what does chief visionary officer mean? You know, that's usually kind of a BS term that you hear a lot when Hollywood types come in to projects like this. But, like, really early on in the conversation, we talk about, okay, what's going on here? What's your involvement? Can you really just parachute into making a video game? And really enjoyed talking with Neil about that. And even give it a little, I don't think it, Rob definitely professed his love or appreciation for Chappie when we did the intro. Once again, recording this without knowing what Kato was going to do with it. I've never seen Chappie. Do I need to watch Chappie? We don't get into that here. But maybe the conclusion of this interview is that I need to watch Chappie. So anyway, on to our interview with Neil Blomkamp.
So, Neil, welcome to Waypoint Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I think my first question is, so what does being a chief visionary officer entail? And is there any way that you avoid being the dreaded ideas guy that is the, you know, natural nemesis of producers and department chiefs working on a project?
I mean, I think any creative lead position is always going to be the nemesis of producers, right? Because you're at odds with budgetary constraints. But you know, over the last few years, I've started to think of it kind of more like it's like a spectrum where the producers are also creative, but they're weighted more towards financial. And the creatives should actually, yes, they're predominantly creative, but they should have a weight towards something with an eye towards being, you know, playing within the box that the budget defines. So they're actually doing, they're both doing the same thing. They're just weighted differently. So with Godzilla, it hasn't really been confrontational at all in that way. It's been good. There's just technical limitations that you run into and scope limitations, and you just have to play within the sandbox. But yeah, Chief Visionary Office is pretty bold. the CEO Vlad Korolev is pretty awesome, and I think he came up with that. And you know, a lot of the time I'll just run with it, so it works.
I was reading that over the years, you know, obviously, you know, your own history with, you know, trying to adapt things like Halo, but also your outward, you're just posting screenshots of like Doom and Counter-Strike to your Twitter accounts, like clearly like a long, and you've spoken about the way things like Half-Life influenced District 9. It's one thing to be like a fan of video games and be like, you know, I'd like to make one of those. Now you're in the mix of like helping craft one of those. I'm so curious, what were some of the assumptions you brought in of like, this is what it's going to be like to build a video game? And then you get in there and it's like, oh no, this is what it's like to build a video game.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's incredibly, you know, you have to go through the process to kind of understand the differences, which I didn't until I began. And it is really interesting. I mean, one of the things with film is, you know, it really is the director's vision, and the crews kind of work towards that, right? Where in games, there are so many departments that are so integral to how the system runs that when the design team, and I had to also learn that like design doesn't mean what I think design is. Design means like the structure of the game, which in this game is headed up by Scott Probyn. And when those guys say like these are some of the aspects that have to happen, right? You have to reverse engineer your creative around these things. Which is different for me. So then it's like you sit down and you go, okay, why? Like, what are the reasons for that? And then they explain them. And each time that happens, you sort of iterate in your own mind and understand more and more about, okay, now I get why they need this. And then some other department says that they need something, and you have to sort of work with that. And you can certainly force things, like more like, you know, like a film director, but it's counterproductive. And the more you learn and understand how the whole organic system is built and why each person is saying something, you become more of a team member and part of the group. And I mean, I certainly am just relying on a bunch of people that really know what they're doing. I'm acting more aesthetically, and you know, it's almost from like a visual and story standpoint with working with Richard Morgan, who wrote Altered Carbon, in the narrative team. So it's very creative for me and very fun, but it's a learning curve. And yeah, when you talk about Counter-Strike and and Half-Life, like that office level from CS, like one of the first batches of Counter-Strike, it's like, man, I spent a lot of time in there, and it's just like, yeah.
Well, I think that sort of leads to one of my other questions, which is that I feel when I think back, for instance, to times that like previous filmmakers got involved with making games, I think maybe most famously or infamously, like Danny Elfman on Homefront, things like that, where they approach it very much as coming from a film background. What story are we telling? What's the shot sequence we're going to go with here? And obviously, like even in narrative games, where it's telling a very linear story, you're still really constrained by the way you can tell the story, like how, like the degree to which you can control the player's attention. But I think it seems like it's even more daunting challenge when you're talking about something like a battle royale, where it's kind of an ongoing universe, and like what you have is a setting that maybe tells a story, but at the same time, sometimes by its very nature, that world is going to be a static playground that players revisit again and again. And I'm just curious, like how you approach the narrative art in a project like this.
Well, I mean, there's two components to your question, right? Like the first one, when you're saying that filmmakers move into games and they focus on like, what story are we telling? I've spent a lot of time thinking about that. And, you know, a lot of, there's a lot of people that have this idea that games and film will sort of eventually merge into one thing. And it's just kind of this narrative world that you're sort of dropped into. And I'm not entirely sure it's going to play out that way. Like my own personal point of view is when you watch films that have an effect on you and they move you, the reason that that's happened is because the writer or the director has a point of view about some emotional experience that they've either lived through or that they have thought a lot about. And when they put it down on paper and turn it into a film, they are basically it's like a small piece of mythology from their mind that they're giving you, right? So you are affected by it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It means you're automatically passive. There's no way around that. And so if you're active, if the player has agency in the world that you've set up, you're not going to ever get that same experience. And I am also not sure that people want that in games, because I think something like GTA is a good example of where I actually think things will go, like hyper photorealistic, borderline real version of GTA, like some place you get dropped into. And then it's more like you're able to do whatever you want. And it feels, and that's literally the direct opposite of being, of ingesting a sort of mythological storytelling from some other mind, right? You just have free agency over the world that you're inside of. So I think those two things are at odds with one another. But in the case of Off the Grid, a lot of the stuff was established by Richard Morgan when I came on board. So, you know, there was a world and a very clear way that the Battle Royale would operate within that world. And I was just stoked to be part of it and sort of piggyback on the back of it and build more. So I didn't come into it going like, well, what story should we tell? I sort of inherited a lot of stuff and then just immersed myself in the team and started working on it. So in this particular case, it totally suits me because I feel like, I mean, I love cyberpunk. I love the setting. I love, there's a lot of stuff in it that I really, really dig. And it's also a good game to kind of cut your teeth on, you know?
I guess I am a little surprised that the project, you know, I read in a previous interview that, you know, obviously you've had different offers or different, you know, conversations about getting involved in games at one point or another. But as someone that comes from a film background in which you have a little more like direct authorship over what the audience is seeing, like the Battle Royale is like the other end of the spectrum of that. And so I'm like, what attracted you like to that specifically, like one where as a creative, you're giving up a lot of that authorship in the process?
Well, I mean, it goes back a little bit to what I was saying before, which is this idea of story versus what I think games actually provide for audiences or players. So I was okay with that. But on another level, when I was much younger, I came out of, you know, in South Africa, I wanted to work in prosthetic effects or visual effects because I didn't know exactly how the whole system of filmmaking happened. And by the time I got to Canada, I realized I could be a director, but I'd already been in animation and visual effects for like a couple of years. And so my obsession in visual effects was photoreal environments and places you could be dropped into where like the light and the sound and the environment is something that is a very much part of the creative process or the creative goal. And when you fast forward now, you know, like 22 years later, things like Unreal 5 and, you know, real time radiosity and light bouncing all over the place and like just the insanity that is happening now on like RTX 3090 cards. It's incredibly
appealing. If you can find one.
Yeah. You can wrestle one for crypto miners' hands. You can play games on it. But that kind of like three-dimensional other world, the sort of this other environment that you're building, you know, is incredibly appealing to me. And then it becomes more like world building then, because then it's like, what is our story? You know, if we go 30 years back and 30 years forward, and this is the snapshot of time that the game takes place in, there's almost like this fractal, never-ending sort of amounts of resolution that you can go into to flesh that world out. And it's I mean, to me, it's like very creatively satisfying. So we're built, in my mind, we're building a sort of like a world, and I want to be part of them.
So here's a question, because that just put me in mind of something else, which is that, God, a colleague of ours, I forget which critic in our space made this observation, so apologies to whoever's idea I'm cribbing here. But they talk about how, like, live service games, as they roll out, like, things like cosmetics, and they do, like, theme packs and, like, tie-ins and such. He talked about, like, how eventually, aesthetically in the set, like, the model for games like this tends to strip away the identity of a world that gets built. Yeah. Because eventually, like, if you have to make room for, and the cast of The Predator is here, and so is the cast of The Terminator, and also, like, DC.
Yeah.
Like, once, like, all these things have to coexist in the space, like, things don't look very much like the world you begin with. Like, I think, like, a lot of special outfits in Halo, for instance. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
That world, like, you see a character like that, you're like, that's not a Spartan.
But the cat ears are so cute, Rob. like, what's let the Spartan have a little cat ear as a treat.
But that's kind of thing. We talk about, like, coming into this from, like, the standpoint of being excited about, like, these details of production and sort of building a world about that. I'm curious, like, what you make of that arc in live service games, where the model often, like, later entails, you know, that visual identity we built up, we're going to smash it. I'm curious what you make of that, and, like, whether you think it ends up, like, changing the feel of a world or a game.
It absolutely changes it. I mean, there's no question. I've spoken to UC, who's the art director at Godzilla, about this, and he always references, like, this, you know, sort of season one hyper real, very cool cyberpunk vibe, and you cut to, like, season 11, and it's just the banana outfit, you know, with, like, cat ears. So you're completely correct. I mean, it is that is a little bit at odds with what interests me about it, for sure. But I also think that there's a lot of thinking that you can do maybe about what some of those cosmetics could be, and doing it in a way that is maybe more integral to the world. But I mean, basically, at some point you have to understand, or I have to understand, that that the playing audience, obviously, en masse, seems to like something about being more and more crazy and being more and more elite, and more and more, like, identifiable and unique in the environment. So you got to sort of challenge yourself to see if you can combine that with something that feels organic to the world.
In your previous project, Demonic, I'm curious if there's any connective tissue between, in that film, you know, a lot of the sequences take place in a virtual world. You play with the camera perspective, like, specifically setting it at isometric, which feels very video gamey. Play with,
that's my favorite shot in that movie. That's
pretty, yeah, and it's
I did that movie for that shot, actually. like the Sims kind of orthographic, isometric point of view.
Right, and it feels extremely trippy if you are unfamiliar with video games and how they handle cameras. Like, I was sitting watching with my wife. She's like, what is going on here? And I was like, oh, well, let me hold on, pause the movie, Google search. And she's like, oh, okay. And I was like, he's a big video game guy. Like, and he's playing. And so having, you know, shot a film in which you're clearly doing kind of a marriage of, like, your creative and personal interest in video games with the sort of, like, horror sci-fi aesthetics and storytelling you do. And now you're in a space where you're, like, actually building a video. I'm curious if there's any connective tissue between Demonic and, like, where you were melding those things, and then actually working with artists, designers, programmers, building a world and building that in a space where you're actually holding the controller.
I would say no, there's no connective tissue. Like, they're just two very separate thought processes. They're not connected. I mean, a lot of what we did with Demonic was, those environments were photogrammetry, right? They were gathered using, they were not modeled and built by artists, and that kind of puts you in a slightly different headspace. So, no, I don't think they're the same. But I do think that at some, you know, very far back basic brain level, I think whoever the creator is of certain various pieces of work, there's always going to be some sort of DNA lineage that ties them together. And that may even be operating subconsciously, you know. So but on a conscious level, no, there's no connection. I mean, Off the Grid is very particularly one thing that I view one way.
So one thing here, we got a press release this morning talking about like how the story evolves and that it's reacting to like, you know, decisions made by the player base, and these things roll across the universe. And maybe it got me thinking, one, that that's a very different promise than like, you know, Fortnite famously is maybe the most successful like game, like evolving game that we see. The rules change year to year, the story, but it's very much an authored story too. Like you're very much just on the receiving end of like, what are we doing this season? And I'm trying to think of like analogies for this, for how this works. The only thing that comes to mind, because it's been like a topic of conversation a lot in our space of late, is like a game called Blazeball. If you're familiar with that, which became a weird internet obsession, where it was like an exercise in the collective storytelling.
Wasn't the original Titanfall a little bit like this, where you had like a mashup of like players and like they're like single player elements in like the multiplayer environment? I remember that being part of that original.
The original Titanfall, it told the story through the levels. So every time you went into a team deathmatch, whatever, if you played the story mode, it was like, and for this one, we're doing control point. And then while you're playing a standard control point map, you have a radio drama like just happening in the background where like Bill Paxton is being like, I can't believe you would do this to us. You're a traitor and stuff like that. But this sounds a little bit more like, the idea is the player base is in here interacting with the world and playing their games, but is also having some sort of collective agency in like what the next stage, what the next chapter of the story looks like. And I'm curious, like, have y'all figured out how this works? Like how is storytelling and like the evolution of this world like anticipated to work in this game?
I mean, we're in the process of figuring it out. A lot of it is discussions about scope and how much we can do. But I think the ambitions are fairly well known, like within the company. I think it's quite clear. It's a question of being able to execute it just based on like actual, you know, physical limits. But I mean, I won't reveal exactly how we're thinking of doing it because we need to know that we can do it first. But I would say, yeah, there is a goal to have a lot of real time story elements that the players are experiencing along with Battle Royale.
I do want to rewind very briefly. I believe at some point you said there, as I was referencing Titanfall, that you need to replay it.
Yeah.
It does beg the question, have you played Titanfall 2?
No.
Oh my God. Okay, Neil, like whatever you do after this call, like really? Titanfall 2, one of the all-time single-player shooters, one of the greatest like sci-fi campaigns in video games. Like there is a time travel level in that game that is one of the greatest things I've ever experienced in a video game. It is unbelievable. It was a game that was like high with critics and just like didn't sell nearly enough, which is why we don't have a Titanfall 3, but
I wonder why. Like if it's so good, like what would the reason be for that?
Rob, it came out at the same time. I think it collided with a bunch of other games that were coming out at the same time, and
just
that
bad timing.
It was extremely bad timing. But it is it's one of those games you'll come out the other end and be like, wow, I can't wait to just download Titanfall 3 and start playing it. And then you'll go, oh no, they made Apex Legends instead, which is an excellent video game, but was I wanted more of my mechs.
Oh, crazy. Okay, yeah, no, I'm pretty familiar with the world of the first one, but I haven't played the second one.
Was there a Weta Workshops connection with that? Or I'm probably thinking of Grey Goo, another game that sort of crashed and burned on launch that I'm really obsessed with. But I am curious, like, as we're sort of reminiscing about, games dearly departed, I am curious, like, in the current landscape, I know that some of the folks that you're working with right now worked on things like Hunt Showdown and such. I'm curious if there are games like in landscape right now or in the past few years that like have sort of spoken to you, if you've had time to play them, that have like spoken to you and that have sort of sparked something that you're taking with you into this project.
Hunt Showdown is actually pretty cool. That game was pretty awesome. I enjoyed that game. In terms of thinking of off the grid or affecting off the grid, Not directly, not that I can think of. But again, I'm approaching it. A lot of the game mechanics and the very complex sort of player mechanics and stuff come from people that are much more experienced than I am. So I'm coming at it more from in a live real time virtual environment. How do we flesh out this world and hopefully some of the story elements? It's a slightly different thought process because I'm not experienced enough to go into it and go like, This is the game that we should make. You know, I need to do this for another 10 years, I think, before it's like I can actually do that.
I wonder, you know, films take a long time to, you know, come into being, but games take, especially these days, an extraordinarily long time to come into being, in which it's one thing to sit in a meeting and say, we would like to do this. And then it's quite another to be at the point where you can actually interact with it. Yeah, and I'm curious, like, what your sort of history, you know, what it's been like so far to be like being like a really exciting, like, jazzed up meeting where you all come out and like, yes, like, these are gonna be some great ideas, can't wait to see them. And it's like, yeah, cool, like in 18 months, hopefully, like, the team's got a prototype that we can show you. It's just the scale of games made, especially at the high end these days, is not 1 year or 2 years, but is like 4 years or five years.
They're massive undertakings. You could almost do like a film jump cut from the enthusiastic young crew on, like, you know, day one to some, like, all the hairs falling out and just like gray and just, you know, hit the like we're a couple of days away from shipping it and it's been really painful. But I think I'm used to those timelines because the films usually take about 2 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you add some months to that, it's not the end of the world. You just have to keep your eye on the larger goal.
I am curious just because I'm, you know, I've sort of been today on Twitter, I've sort of been noticing some of the discourse around like the fact that the latest Marvel movie is like booked out complete multiplexes. It's wall to wall. And I'm curious, like, one thing that I often hear in relation to like the current cinematic landscape is like it's hard enough to like make a film. Mm-hmm. But now it's so hard even to get an idea out there, to even get something like greenlit and like find a space for it in the market.
You mean that isn't Marvel, that isn't IP that people know?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm curious, like, your take on that. Like, does it feel, especially as someone who is like sort of known for building like new worlds and like telling new stories rather than sort of recycling, you know, previous settings. Like, I'm curious, like, how you react to that. Like, where, like, is film still a exciting possibility space for a person with like a lot of like storytelling and world building ambition?
I think it's dying off for sure. I mean, to me it does feel quite the only options you really do have. It's almost like, in a lot of ways, the kind of the middle, like you referenced Chappie earlier, and it's like the films like Chappie, this kind of between $40 to $60 million film where there's enough money to like really put some imagery on screen, but it isn't like, it's not $120 million or $200 million. That zone of film with IP that it doesn't exist, you know, which is a new idea. That feels like it's a dying breed. And I don't think that's a good thing at all. You know, I really just don't. I think it's like for all of the Star Wars films that are out there, it's almost like people have forgotten that when George Lucas made it in 77, it was like no one had seen anything like it before because he was striving to do something that was a bit different. And there's a complete saturation now of just bankable known IP that will absolutely strangle out new ideas. So they tend to operate at much lower budget levels. And you know, it's just how it goes. So I don't think it's a good thing. I don't think it's a good thing.
Well, that's it seems to partially lead you to doing a lot of crowdfunding endeavors to like find alternative ways of, hey, these are the things I want to do. You know, now that I've got this passionate fan base coming out of the films I've done before. Okay. Well, if I can't get what I want done through the traditional means, maybe I can ask the fans for help, which has happened a lot in video games as well. Like lots of classic video games have come back only through the will of fans being like, yeah, of course I'd put $5 to see you know, this designer go revisit something that they did 30 years ago.
Yeah, it almost feels like the more centralized Hollywood becomes, the more decentralized the online community is becoming. And this kind of Kickstarter approach to, you know, other forms of creativity will probably only grow. But I mean, it's still, there's a massive delta between something that costs $60 million and, like, you know, you're just making two different things. But there are, I mean, obviously there are still companies like A24, and like there are studios that do things that are pretty cool. But it's kind of like what you're missing is like something along the lines of like the first Matrix, say, right? Where I want that experience. And I think it's harder for filmmakers. I don't know if the Wachowskis could do that in 2022.
Well, and that's sort of like, from your standpoint, I'm curious, like, obviously you're working right now on a video game. But like, in terms of where you look for future projects and where your like interest and effort lie as a creator, like, do you still look toward like major motion pictures? Do you look toward like more indie stuff? Do you like TV is often held out as like, well, you know, the great filmmaking, the great adult films of like 20, 25 years ago, now they are prestige TV series. And that's where, you know, the stuff is blooming. I'm curious, like, how you sort of like, where do you see yourself in that landscape? Where are your ambitions point from here?
I mean, I have some TV projects that I'm developing because TV is interesting. But for the way my brain works, there's something about the sort of the campfire storytelling of like a sort of roughly 2-hour film that has there really is a mythological element to that I'm not, you don't get from TV, despite how like Game of Thrones, if aliens came to Earth and it was like, let's talk about like some of the sort of human achievements in art, I almost think Game of Thrones would be in there because it's so ridiculously massive in terms of scale and just the endeavor is very impressive, right? But you still don't get something like this, the kind of 3-act structure and wrap up of a sort of mythological story, like say the end of the first Matrix. It doesn't affect you the same way, right? It's a different kind of thing. It's like you're delving more into character and longer form storytelling. It doesn't hit you the same way in a theater with experience with other people. And I'm on an emotional creative level, like I'm drawn to that experience. It's like one thing that's all focus that the audience walks out of the movie theater after having seen. That's personally what I'm drawn to. And then when you get into it, then it's like, well, what exactly is the film that you're making in there? Because a lot of it is based on existing IP now. And it's like, that's cool. You know, you can play that game, but then you must also make space as well to tell some of your own stories. And games are becoming increasingly more interesting to me, like especially with things like Unreal 5 and just the level of, you know, the level of immersion that you can put people into is really fascinating. So I was like really happy to be contacted by Godzilla, like, I don't know, like 1.5 years ago or however long it's been. I want to do it more.
All right. Well, I think we're just about out of time and it's been a great conversation. I think we can leave it there. Neil, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us and we can't wait to hear more about Off the Grid.
Yeah, well, thanks to you guys. And also, I love the Children of the Corn shirt.
Oh, thank you. Yes, you know, one thing I will say is the second and third films are better than you'd think. There's like 10 of those. There's like a weird rights issue where it just never reverts back to King. Or it's like, because he's like pretty specific about how he like distributes those rights. Like, there's just some studio that just kind of like the Weinstein Company when they had like Hellraiser and something like that. Yeah. It's like, look, as long as they make one every year, those rights never go anywhere.
Yeah.
So you don't want to watch Children of the Corn 10 unless you're a complete weirdo.
I feel like you rarely want to watch any movie that's named 10.
I would argue when I see, you know, a film series has gotten a 10, I need to see how we got there. And then you get to Jason X. And so anyway, I would, you know, Titanfall 2 and then Children of the Corn 2 and 3 would be my recommendations coming out of this conversation.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Yeah, take care. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Many thanks to Neil for joining us. That was a delight to have a brief conversation with the filmmaker who's made some movies I really, really like. And even the ones that are kind of a swing and a miss are interesting swing and a misses. Go watch the horror movie Demonic he did during COVID. It's aesthetically wild. And he has done some really cool shorts as well. But that's a wrap on today's episode of Waypoint Radio. If you want more from Waypoint, you can follow us on Twitter @Waypoint, Facebook, YouTube @Waypoint Vice. sign up for Waypoint Plus at waypointplus.com. You can listen manhunting. You'll be able to get a commentary for our upcoming, not directors, a commentary track we're going to do for The Thing from Another World, the 1951 film that made a big impact on John Carpenter before he directed his own take on The Thing. Lots of other stuff on Waypoint Plus. Lots of really, really good stuff. Our theme music is by Bowen. The track is Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can learn more at waypoint.zone/Bowen. That's it. That's it for today. We'll be back on Friday. Until then, fuck capitalism. Go home. That's Chappy.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.